Welcome back. We have a big program tonight packed with information that you'll hear nowhere else. Clifford Carnicom has been a friend and a colleague of all of ours for many, many years. He is, without question, in my humble estimation, the number one American researcher, real American researcher, in terms of the aerosol chemtrail crimes and the cover-up therein. Clifford began researching this a long time ago. His website is Carnicom, C-A-R-N-I-C-O-M, Carnicom.com, and it is loaded with information about chemtrail aerosol crimes, information, again, that is stunning. This man has now turned his attention to a substantial degree to another grave problem confronting perhaps tens of millions of Americans. It is Morgellons disease, Morgellons affliction, Morgellons syndrome, whatever you want to call it. It is Morgellons. It is an extraordinarily complicated, very mysterious and frightening issue, which we have covered in this program. I think we've done 13 special programs on it now. Clifford has begun to publish his data, and I am very pleased to have him on the program tonight to hear firsthand from him what he has found out and what his opinions and what his research are indicating are very important directions and parameters regarding this unknown issue, which clearly is life-threatening to many and life-destroying for even many more. Welcome back to the program, Clifford. How are you?
Great, Jeff. Thanks very much for the chance to be here and to help get some of the information out. I know you've done quite a few shows on this subject, and I'm only one person of many, and I appreciate the invitation and offer to share at least one aspect of it.
Well, I'm honored to do so, and I think we should, you just said to share at least one aspect of it, and I think it's important for all of you listening, especially those who have Morgellons or know people who do or who are interested, and you government types as well who are covering this up and who damn well know a lot about this. Clifford is one man. His research is his. He does not speak, nor does he pretend to speak for the entire Morgellons research effort, but his material is extremely important to consider, and that's why I'm very pleased to have him with us tonight. All right, my friend, let's jump right into it.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. And I think at the onset, and I'll probably do this, in the middle of our show also, but you know, it should be clearly stated that, you know, I am not a medical doctor. The information that we're talking about tonight is that being offered by an independent researcher. I have no medical background. I'm offering no diagnosis. I'm offering no therapy, no prescription, no final assessment of anything from a medical point of view. But I am offering what are observations over an extended period of time that I believe, and it really has nothing to do with belief systems. You know, that word comes into things, but my work
really has
nothing to do with belief systems. But
I understand.
But to the best of my ability, the results are sincere and genuine and are offered to the public for the public welfare.
In that spirit,
as a path. To investigate, and so that's what I do. And there's nothing about anything medical being offered here tonight from my side.
I understand.
I sent you a brief outline of three things on my mind tonight, and the majority of the time I thought might be helpful to go through the chronology of some of the work I've been involved in over the last, I guess it's about 5 months now, something like that.
You've been very heavily involved in it, and I want to mention to our listeners, we will not get through all of Clifford's material tonight, and so I've invited him to come back in the next week or two at his convenience, and we will continue this conversation. So please go ahead, Clifford.
Okay, thanks. And because of that, I may not try to squeeze through all these articles, and I may just get as far as we can, and maybe we can carry it up at another time. I will give the audience, ahead of time, where this discussion is going, so that as we go through the material, we won't be surprised at the end of what it's leading to. And the research that's been going on for the past 5 to 6 months strongly suggests or indicates, whatever word you choose to use, but strongly indicates that the general population could literally be the general population of the planet, but that the general population is almost certainly at consideration for being at risk, at the very least, maybe a subject, but at the very least is certainly a risk candidate for being affected by these symptoms and or manifestations that we're speaking of tonight. And I know that that's a strong statement, but the fact is that that's what the evidence is leading to at this point. And the notion that there is, in fact, when you hear me use the word Morgellons now, in my mind, it is always put in quotation marks. It is always qualified, because the notion that has developed that Morgellons is some kind of condition that affects a small group of people that we tend to look at with a separate eye from ourselves appears to me to be erroneous. From the information evidence I have, it appears to be erroneous. And that the characteristics of what it is that we are attributing to that condition appear to be much deeper embedded than that, and may possibly involve the general population.
And when you say deeper embedded, we can actually take that to mean literally in the human body. It is not a skin disorder.
Exactly. This is where this work is going to. So that'll give people, you know, up front, my assessment at this time as to the seriousness and nature of what it is we're speaking tonight about. So I thought what I would do is go through this chronology and a little bit of where it started. There actually was some early work. If you actually look, you know, if we were to trace it back originally, there was some biological work that was very, very interesting involving the presence of erythrocytes, what appeared to be freeze-dried or desiccated erythrocytes or red blood cells. Also, a report I issued, a personal paper regarding some fibrous dental material, done probably at least 5 years, with no strong claims being made at that point of any tie-ins, but did express that there were, let's say there was an interest developing in an illness condition that certainly was being characterized by the presence of fibrous, but that was made just as sort of an opening suggestion that there might be something to look at here, having no direct tie-in with the aerosol issue. Popularly referred to.
When you mention the desiccated or freeze-dried erythrocytes, are you alluding to the one in particular case in Washington State or other areas as well?
No, I'm referring to specific environmental testing that I did.
In your location?
Many times, yes, and also surrounding states.
Okay, very good.
That showed the physical presence over and over and over of what appeared, the best I can come up with is that of a desiccated erythrocyte. So there are some points to this that go way back. In fact, the more that we learn, it looks like they may well come back to haunt us, particularly as we learn more about certain blood anomalies that are appearing. But if we jump ahead of that, then there was a break. We'll find that my research was actually fairly quiet after the documentary I produced for probably a year and a half, something like that. But then in August of 2006, I put up a paper, and that title of that paper was called Morgellons First Observations. And I think, I could be mistaken, but I think we actually did an interview right after that paper was done.
We did.
And that paper was significant to me in that it was the first time that I was aware that any sufficiently high magnification images of the physical forms that were being described were shown. I got under the microscope, and I worked on the microscope quite a bit over the years to try to get the best I can. My means are quite modest, and people should understand that. I've had people criticize the quality of my microscope images, but when you're basically adapting affordable and existing technology, and you get up to the 5,000 to 7,000 power on a conventional light microscope, it actually is an accomplishment of some sort, because conventional microscopy is limited to roughly 1 to 2,000 power. And to get above that without having access to, you know, electron microscopes or very high quality gear. It is difficult, but I've done that, at least to the degree that I can. And it ends up being important because that difference, you know, when you start getting around 3,000, 4,000, and eventually I'm up to about 7 now, max,
that
difference is enough to make a difference entirely about the process of discovery and what we're talking about.
Absolutely. Stand by, Clifford, if you would. That's a truly an amazing accomplishment for anyone to pull up resolutions in the 5,000 to 7,000 power range. As a layperson, just a really an amazing achievement. Back in just a couple minutes with Clifford Carnicup. Hi, we're back with Clifford Carnicom, and we are working our way through his introductory remarks about his Morgellons research. Go ahead, Clifford.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jeff. Mm-hmm. I do think that microscopy is extremely important because it serves as a starting point. In other words, if you're interested in seeing what something is and you know it's happening at the microscopic level, right, then get under the scope and see what it looks like and get the best equipment you can and start by at least seeing what it is you're talking about.
Right.
And, you know, it's not sufficient for people to say what might be there. I think you just need to get the materials and resources to look at it, and that's what I've done to the best of my ability. And if we look at that first paper, you know, I'm recalling this now, that paper was called Morgellons First Observations.
Yep.
If we look at the photographs on that paper, a great amount of information was actually disclosed at that time. If you actually look at these photographs in detail, you end up basically establishing the basis or framework for that which has now taken close to a year and a half, mm-hmm, as a follow-up to basically affirm, confirm, and then extrapolate to a much broader manifestation in the human body.
It was an extraordinary harbinger of what was to come, and I hear a little bit of surprise in your voice as to how accurate it was.
Well, it certainly is on the mark from what I see. As I'm looking at these photographs, mm-hmm, now, you know, we knew a year and a half ago now what certain forms looked like, and we had a basis upon which to begin a very serious investigation. And, you know, it's not a secret also that I'm extremely disappointed in the rate of that progress. There is just absolutely no excuse for this type of information being made available at a public level. And, you know, you're the primary person, at the very least one of the primary people that has helped to disseminate this information. And to think that this information is out there publicly for a year and a half and absolutely nobody with a scope or the chemical or laboratory resources to go to work on this, to me, it's just reprehensible.
Well,
so my position.
At least that we know about, and we know that the people who work at taxpayer expense at certain levels in certain institutions are probably looking at this very intently and have a pretty damn good idea of what some of the parameters are.
Absolutely, and unfortunately, you know, the performance of the institutions speak for themselves, and I think that, you know, we're at a point where the public, and have been for some time now that the public has to take ownership of these issues. And if you're counting on some agency coming to your rescue, sorry, it's not in place. It's not in place. So, you know, we have to call upon ourselves. So if you look at these photographs, you see three or four basic forms going on here. And one is you have what I will eventually call, as we lead into this discussion, I'll say that I'm finding four basic forms. One of them will be what I call a bounding filament or an encasing or a surrounding filament. The second will be that of a submicron filament network. The third will be a submicron spherical or oblate structure. And the fourth one will be what I call a hybrid, because I really can't pin down any further than that. It appears to, I would characterize it as a ribbon-like form. If you look at these early photographs, they're showing three out of four of those forms very clearly. You have this bounding filament. Now, this is a, and you know, we certainly recall Jan Smith. She was a contributor to this article, and she's been on your show many times, I think. And she provided these samples to me, got them under the scope. And you see exactly this, that which, you know, people were being called delusional, all the games and tricks that were being played. We got it under the scope directly, and you can see that any notion of it being any kind of regular filament are thrown out the door. You have a bounding filament that's roughly in the order of, call it 12 to 20 microns in thickness, it appears to me generally. A human hair is 60 to 100. So you had this filament that some people might claim is a hair. That becomes absurd as soon as you get under the scope. Not only do you have this bounding filament, that, but then within it, you have this entire network of fibers. And this is where you need that scope at that level to see these things. You just do not see it at, you know, 700, 1,000 power. But you see this entire network of parallel fibers within the encasing fiber at the submicron level. In addition, as you go down through these further, you start seeing a circular or oblate, you know, slightly off-center structure, very small. If you measure this, it ends up at about 5 to 7 tenths of a micron, is occurring within that fiber over and over and over. And then the last one, which is actually, in one sense, I could even say five forms. I'm just describing this four. But if you actually look at these papers, you see something else that's really important. That is, you see this budding structure. You see a potential growth mechanism on this fiber, and that is on the side of the fiber. You see no other term I could come up with other than a bud. It's an encapsulated structure that within it, what's in it? More fibers and more of these oblate or spherical structures at the submicron level. Literally as though it's a process of regeneration or growth on that fiber.
So this
was all known as of August of 2006.
Right, agreed. All right, stand by. We'll take a quick break and come right back. And continue our conversation about Morgellons with Clifford Carnicombe. Back with citizen scientists and hero Clifford Carnicombe, and I just remember all of the incredible programs we've done over the years with Clifford, talking about the aerosol spraying program, which continues to ravage not only this country but other countries as we speak. Go ahead, Clifford, with your Morgellons data, and I'm going to put your Morgellons first observations article under your name in guests in just a few minutes. So we'll put that back up for people to refer to.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
You're welcome.
I think I'll probably save that RIFE discussion for another time because I'm pretty sure I'm not going to get to it.
All right, but what we might do is spend just a couple minutes on the general parameters of it, and I think it does merit mention in passing because it's...
That would be great. If you can catch me, I would be glad to do it.
Okay.
I think it would be helpful. So, you know, you have this first paper put up in August of 2006, and basically you have a year and a quarter pass.
Mm-hmm.
And from my standpoint, nothing happens in the sense of I don't know anything more. Now, you have Dr. Saniger on the show many times, and I know she did quite a bit of work on the chemical analysis where we had some samples sent to some proper labs for some chemical analysis, and that was helpful information. But from the standpoint of morphology, form, and structure, which I think is important, in other words, if you have a biological form showing up or an altered biological form, you need to know what that thing is doing. You need to know the purpose of it. You need to know the function of it. You need to know
Right. We have a right to that. You're right.
You need to know the reproductive cycle.
Or replication cycle, or self-assembling, or whatever you want to call it.
And chemistry might be valuable, but it's only one small part of the picture. And what something does and how it reproduces is, in many ways, absolutely fundamental to making progress on this issue. So a year and a quarter passes, and personally, from my standpoint, I don't see any progress on that front. And in November of 2007, last year, and also I can't do any more at that point. This happens to be the kindness of Jan that made this available to me, and I had no other people offering or providing this to me at this point.
Bless Jan Smith.
That was the start of this.
Right.
And so in November 2007, I meet another individual directly. You know, Jan was on the other side of the country, but I meet another individual that, you know, tells me they have symptoms. They've actually had them for a while, and they pretty much kept them sort of quiet at a personal level.
A lot of people do.
But I have these, you know, sores on my skin, and I have these fibers. And this person also, in a very, very unselfish and kind and generous manner, made herself or himself available for observation of biological samples in scrutiny. You know, and that takes a lot of a person, I have to say, to be able to put themselves out like that. That's not an easy thing to do. But this person did that, you know, very, very unselfishly. And so I got under the scope again. And this time I had the benefit of going from dead scratch. And if you see this paper, it's titled Morgellons Morphology Confirmed. And at this point, I could start at the skin from the very, you know, basically take a perspective from far away and move in to the best that my equipment was able to provide. And if you look at the photographs on this site, you'll see photographs of the back of the individual. You'll see the skin lesions that many of us are now, unfortunately, familiar with. It's very sad, really, to see. It's very sad to see this. And sores that don't heal. And then we progress to an extraction or a sample from one of these sores. And you can, by eye, just barely see certain fibers emanating from that extraction. Looks like it's probably about a quarter inch long would be my guess. I do know it was extremely painful for these to be pulled from the skin. And what you'll see is a series of photographs that gradually increase the magnification to show us a little bit more each time about what is really going on here. And the main advantage here is you're going from the skin, absolute, you know, raw sample,
right,
all the way down.
Right.
And if you follow these photographs through, you are led to the same identical observations and conclusions of that first paper. Now, some people can just dismiss that and say, oh, old hat, okay, I'm seeing it again. No,
no,
that's not the way I see it.
No.
I see a year and a quarter passing by where very likely some very important information was made available.
Yep.
No proper assessment, diagnosis, or research of that issue to the level it needs. The CDC is sitting on this the whole time this is going on and still continues to sit on it, as far as I'm concerned.
And will continue.
Yes, absolutely. It's quite predictable what game is being played there. They're just buying time, and they bought close to many, many years, let's say, already they have purchased.
Agreed.
And if you look at these pictures, you see the same exact structures. In other words, what do you see? You see the encasing filament. You see the submicron parallel fibrous network. You see the submicron oblate or circular structure. You see the budding structure. And there's question of whether or not that ribbon form or hybrid form is showing up at this point. So what do you have? You have rather serious conformation at a level that cannot be seen through conventional microscopic means of most extraordinary structures emanating from the human body, specifically the skin, that are now clearly affecting the state of health of individuals. Now, the very last photograph on that set, and I know, you know, people that are listening may not be able to see, so I'll just do the best I can to describe it. But that last photograph on that set, we could call it an accident, we could call it serendipitous, we could call it intuition, whatever you want. But a unique little twist occurred on that last photograph that I present, and that is, at the last minute, I was just sort of playing around with the laser light that I have, and I subjected that sample to lighting by a laser light, a red laser. And again, people, you know, there's a caveat on the site, but obviously be careful. Nothing I was doing, I was never looking at it with my eye. It was all through digital means projected on a scope. You'd be very careful ever even considering getting a laser near your eye, so I wasn't doing that. But there was quite a revelation there, and that is there was a great deal of structure going on within this sample that you could not even begin to see until it had been illuminated by this laser light. And you know what? I made a reference to this oblate or spherical submicron structure.
Right, right.
You know, we're talking about a little ball, basically. What do you see there? You see these by the thousands in this sample. Not just a few by eye, as I had seen before, but you see them by the thousands within this sample. And so now it changes the whole dimension about the number and magnitude of this particular form.
Agreed. All right, stand by. We'll be back. This is information, again, you are here nowhere else. We owe it all to Clifford Carnicom, Jan Smith, and the few other heroes who have been working. But Clifford is a man that I trust absolutely implicitly to do the finest, high-quality, highest-quality scientific research of anyone that I know, frankly. We'll be right back. Okay, back with Clifford Carnicom, and we're already learning remarkable things. Okay, Clifford, please continue.
Thanks, Jeff. At this point, it had been learned, and somewhat accidentally, that a laser light, for whatever reason, is helpful and beneficial in sometimes revealing structure under the microscope that you would just never see with the normal lighting and visible light. And that was certainly interesting along the way. And also, I will say there was now a percolated interest in that submicron structure that I was seeing, because now I was seeing that there were far, far more of these than I ever had any notion of.
If I might, Clifford is talking about submicron. Now, the average virus is approximately a micron in size and smaller, so we're down there. We're down. Okay, we're just
as far as I can get. Yeah. I mean, you know, at this point.
Well, that's remarkable. You can get that low.
It's Rife microscope or electron microscope. Yeah. You know that we're working with at this point.
Okay.
Enhancement of the CCD technology I'm using. So we see some things that we could never see before with the normal eye and lighting. So again, we could call this somewhat the quirk of the way I work, however that happens. But I decided to put my own blood under the scope, and I subjected my blood sample to this laser light. I suppose out of curiosity more than anything, what would a laser show if I looked at blood? So I did it. And I noticed, the word I would use to describe this would be a hot spot. In other words, as you're looking through the sample, reasonably low magnification, what I would call low now, 750 these are running at. That's about getting near the upper limit of a regular scope. But I'd notice these spots that would really capture the laser light, really intense, and would just sort of cause that whole area to glow within, or, certainly be illuminated within
as
that
in,
blood sample.
As in fluoresce?
No, that's improper
just
me to say
glow.
That.
It's not
but,
a fluorescent,
but
it
much,
is.
Very much, whole entirely different, refractive and reflective
okay.
quality to the sample, that's for sure.
Gotcha.
And then you would also start to see, again, this is fairly low magnification work by the current standards, but also you would get this same hint of these internal submicron structures showing up within the cells. You would start to see congregations of cells. It would just basically look very disturbed. It was it's darkened areas of the blood. And after a while, after I got trained in what I was doing, I was able to see these with a visible eye. But it was the laser light that brought them to my attention. After you've trained your eye, then you do start to notice them under conventional lighting as darkened areas in the blood appear to be disturbed. And so I saw this, in this case, I have to say, within my own blood, I was seeing this. And so I recorded those observations, really didn't know what to make of it, truly didn't know exactly what was normal, not normal at that point. Wasn't unduly concerned other than it was certainly an anomaly to me. And then remember that I had access to this individual that had severe, severe manifestations of the so-called Morgellons condition at the skin level. So I had access to this individual. So, of course, it was curious to me what would the blood of that individual look like under the scope. And this will be at the tail of that article. At the end of the article, you will see the blood of that individual presented. But basically, it's everything that I was seeing, but let's just call it a lot more extreme, a lot more severe. The number and presence of these anomalies was greater. The breach or damage to the cellular integrity was greater. The extent of the degradation and anomalies was greater. But by and large, that was the main difference in that the basic anomaly that was being seen here was occurring both within the individual that had what I would call severe manifestation of the so-called Morgellons condition, and here another individual, which happens to be me, but no visible symptoms of any kind, no reason to think that, oh, well, gee whiz, does Clifford have Morgellons? Well, no reason to think of it in those terms at all. No visible manifestation of any kind.
Understand.
So at that point, I opened up the question a little bit more and just said, well, what about some other folks? If some people are willing to just offer a blood sample, why don't we record it? And again, the whole medical caveat is here is could be I'm an observer. I am permitted to stick my eyeball to the microscope and record what I see and make it available to the public. I'm entitled to do that, and I shall. And so I put other samples under the scope, and I record them, and I present that. And what you see, what you see is that really across the board, in all the samples that I was taking, regardless of whether somebody manifested a skin condition or not, you see the presence of the same anomalous forms. And now you start to see another tie-in that's occurring, and that is this submicron oblate spherical structure that I'm talking about is starting to show up in these blood samples to the degree that I am able to match them by size, shape, and structure to the same form that is showing up in the fibrous sample from the skin.
Give us a very quick, if you can, and this is not easy, description of the shape of these oblique forms that
they're so small that I can't go any further than that. In other words, they appear to be generally spherical, but sometimes slightly off-center, and that's where oblate would come from.
Uh-huh.
You know, you're dealing with something so small with the availability of my equipment. If we have the right equipment,
right.
I mean, you know, in the end, this is the smallest structure that I'm able to identify, and
so
you will see.
They're roundish, is what you're saying. Now, are they exhibiting, now this is in blood, are they exhibiting unusual motile factors?
No, nothing I can see at this point. Of course, the blood smears are dry, so they're not going to move anywhere.
It's not living
blood.
But,
you know, the form, the general form here would be considered that of a coccus bacterial form.
Okay.
That would be the strongest analogy that could be made at this point.
Okay.
Spherical form of a bacterial form would be one very strong candidate here. Again, not saying that that's what it is, and we'll talk more about that later.
Which paper of yours is
we're talking about?
Which paper do those images show up in? That
the first time you start seeing them, and actually, I didn't even realize it at the time, but this paper called "Blood Testing: Lasers, Morgellons, and Fungus." Big question mark after the fungus still is.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's saying, but the big question mark. If you look at these photographs, you have to follow through, and actually I have one of them mislabeled. I have to get the magnification right, because there's one that's off that's actually very important.
Uh-huh.
In terms of photographs, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, oh, shucks, it's way down there, Jeff, on me. But it's subject number, there's five subjects here, five people.
Uh-huh.
And if you look at subject number five, which will be at the bottom, and this is the individual that does have the physical skin symptoms, okay? And the magnification is wrong. It says 750, but that's more like at least 1,500 to 2,000. If you look really close, though, you start to see these bumps showing up within the cell, little spherical structures showing up within these blood cells that are disturbed.
Uh-huh.
Now, I didn't even really recognize them at that point for the significance that I'm giving them later. But as I look back, this is the first time that I'm seeing those structures at that level.
Excuse me, Clifford, please. I want to make sure people can find these things.
Sure.
Is this on your page of Carnicum Research on Morgellons, which I have at my site? Would it be Morgellons 5 or 5th, 6th, and 7th matches? Would that be the paper?
Negative. Negative.
Okay,
this is a paper that is entitled Blood Testing. Lasers,
okay.
Morgellon, and fungus. And let's see, on my main page,
okay,
which is, let's see, Carnicum.com, right?
Yep.
The blue page, Carnicum.com, you'll see an entry that says blood testing. That's it.
How far down the page?
Are you on the blue page?
Yeah.
Yeah, the blue page, about halfway through the page. All these
articles. I see it.
Yeah, they're listed in chronological order, Jeff.
Okay, we go to blood testing, and there it is. I'll put a link up to this as well. I see it now.
Okay.
All of you online, go to Clifford's page, carnicum.com, and simply scroll down. You'll see it. It's Morgellons, and they're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 or so down from the word Morgellons. You'll see blood testing. It's right there. Click on that. Okay, thank you.
I'll change the magnification because that one's up a little higher than it shows. And so what you have here are five individuals essentially chosen at random, one of them seriously manifesting skin conditions.
Got it.
But at the blood level, you see a pretty much, exact match, if not similarity, in terms of anomalous forms that are showing up within the blood. And the only thing that actually seems to vary here is the amount, the magnitude, the extent, the distribution, the severity. But in terms of presence, it appears to be across the board, without question, amongst all these five individuals. That raises some real serious questions here, because you have a correspondence of form, physical form, taking place within the blood and the fibrous form, originally identified, supposedly restricted to those that have the so-called Morgellons condition. And then you also have this showing up in a variety of individuals that have no visible manifestation whatsoever going on of what
Got
we
it.
Perceive
right.
to be the so-called Morgellons condition.
Well, we'd call it subclinical, but in a way it's no longer subclinical because you've identified it. You found it.
The photographs are there.
Yeah, subclinical in terms of, well, it's not on the skin, but we have to keep in mind, we've got a break here, we've got to keep in mind that Morgellons, whatever it is not simply a skin disorder. That's the major point that Clifford has just made, and you must understand that. People who have the skin manifestations may be exhibiting latter stage Morgellon infestation or affliction or syndrome, whatever you want, but it is not a skin disease. So running off to your dermatologist isn't going to do you any good. This is a blood issue, and with the proper kind of effort from people like Clifford, we're able to identify things now in blood. And this brings up, of course, dark field microscopy and how valuable that could be to helping people understand that this is probably an issue that is afflicting tens, maybe hundreds of millions of people. Okay, welcome back. I'm Jeff Rentz. That's R-E-N-S-E. We invite you to our website at rentz.com. Clifford Carnicom is with us tonight. We're talking about Morgellons, and it is a powerfully important subject. Clifford will be back with us on Thursday, May the 8th, for 2 full hours to continue his conversation. Another half an hour to go, so Clifford, let's go right back to it.
Thank you, Jeff, very, very much. And you know, at this point, there's a deeper problem that's starting to emerge, and that is the extrapolation that what we are attempting in the past to restrict to a certain set of individuals as supposedly having a skin condition in no way appears to be restricted to visible manifestation of any kind. In other words,
agreed.
The general population at this point becomes a subject of investigation, the general population. And that's a rather, let's say, serious threshold and transformation.
Well, that's why the CDC is trying desperately to broom this aside. They gave Kaiser Permanente $300,000+, which is pocket change to allegedly study this. And yet you will never be contacted, nor will any of the other serious Morgellons researchers be contacted. This is an effort clearly to obfuscate and push the issue aside. So
it absolutely is, and has been from day one. And maybe as we go along here, if we get time, hopefully I'll get to that in the next few minutes, but there is a tie-in with the aerosol issue that comes up, whether we like it or not.
I want to commend also the work of Cliff Mickelson, who came forward first along with this program and really exposed that CDC fraud. It's sickening. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So the next paper is the one you were referring to, Jeff, and it's called Airborne Skin and Blood, a Match. And this is dated December 10th, 2007. And a couple things that are important here. Number one, it is on this page that you are seeing now all of the four basic forms that I am repeatedly identifying. And by the time we're done, we'll realize that these four forms are occurring across the spectrum of the human body. All major systems of the human body are showing these forms.
All major systems, that's amazing.
Yes, the digestive system, the skin, the saliva, the urinary tract, the blood, all major functional systems of the body are showing these same four basic forms. And this paper is the first one to start to collect these all in one place. And if you start going through this, you'll see, you'll see the skin fiber coming in. You'll see three of the four forms at that point. You'll see the encasing filament. You'll see the submicron network. You see the submicron oblate or spherical structures. Then you get into the blood. And now in the blood, for the first time, you see this, what I'm calling the hybrid form. You start to see a ribbon-like structure. It's not straight filament, not straight, spherical, sort of somewhat in between, more like a ribbon, parallel ribbons.
At what magnification? What magnification, Clifford?
These are coming in at 2,500 that you're starting to see this form.
Okay.
And it's somewhat in between, you know, the filament form. I don't know. That's why I've called it hybrid, because it's somewhere in the middle. It appears to be a state of transformation or transition to me. And in addition, in his blood samples, and this was a sample from the person with a serious skin condition, you also see those spherical structures very clearly. And then, now you start to have the blood. Now I'm getting the blood up to 5,000 power. And this gets pretty interesting on this page, because you start to see this ribbon structure much more clearly. But what's rather incredible and fascinating here is that ribbon structure is occurring, by all appearances, it is occurring within the blood cell, not around the blood cell, but within the blood cell.
Mm-hmm.
You basically are seeing what looks like sort of a sausage form. When I say ribbon, something like a sausage form would be similar also. And this is at 5,000 power. And you see, you just don't see it until you start getting the proper level of resolution and equipment to get into this. And
what
so
you're
now
saying
you're looking,
here, what you're, excuse me, Clifford, what you're saying, what I think I'm hearing, is a hierarchy of visible forms of an incredibly sophisticated and complicated issue.
Oh, absolutely. And once we see something inside the cell, you know, now the whole picture changes, because first of all, you wouldn't even see that. You wouldn't even see this normally. And, you know, it happens to be the CCD technology is actually pretty good. I think I've played with the dark field, or at least homebrew dark field stuff myself. And, and electron microscopes have some difficulties in that they coat things with metal, and you don't get on the inside of things a lot of times, apparently.
Yep.
And it's interesting what the CCD technology can do, because you're actually looking inside the cell, the best I can come up with. I can come to no other conclusion. I actually tried to make this be something that was attached to the outside of the cell, but from my standpoint, that's been disproven.
Wow.
Now, another major, let's say, revelation, this is sort of rather a key link, but also in this picture, you will now see a reexamination. I went back to the original sample that was submitted to the Environmental Protection Agency, the airborne sample.
Yeah, I remember
that.
Well,
you and I have talked about for so many years.
Oh, yeah.
I went back to that now that I had the equipment running at 5,000 power, 7,000 power.
Uh-huh.
And I totally revisited that sample in a way that I've never been able to do before.
Uh-huh.
And what do you see? It's rather astounding. But on that fiber that was sent to the EPA, which I knew was operating at the submicron level, I knew that. But now you see for the first time the same exact form. If you look at this, you can't really tell any difference in form, size, shape, or structure between this fiber that has been sent to the EPA and these skin fibers that you and I are talking about tonight in detail. The same exact internal size. You have the encasing filament, and you have the submicron filament.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, within the EPA, you know, the more I look at these, the more I say, you know, it looks like I'm dealing likely with all basic four forms, certainly three of them, though. The encasing filament, the parallel network, and that submicron spherical structure.
Uh-huh.
That's a key thing to now identify, that you have a exact match in forms, shape, and structure and size between this airborne sample that the EPA refused to identify from moment one,
yep,
and the biological samples that are manifesting across the broad functional aspects of the human body, not anything about just skin. That's to me, it's a rather, let's say, important revelation at that
it's a
point.
It's a stunning revelation, because what Clifford is saying is that these same things are airborne. Okay, I want all of you to follow that. They are airborne, and they are also found within the human bloodstream.
You have a link now. You have a link at the very least for examination, cross examination,
right,
between the airborne environmental samples and that which manifests in the human body. And I will have to say, you know, I do have a problem with, you know, there are those that have claimed we're dealing with, you know, nanorobots and artificial technology and this type of thing. And I have a little problem in the sense that if somebody claims that, you need to be able to show it. What, you know, nanotechnology is visible with the right stuff, believe me. It's not something, but if you put something off where you're talking about it, cannot show it. And what I try to do is simply say, this is what I see, folks. This is the record of how I'm seeing it and what methods I'm using. And there is a fundamental need to to identify, establish what you can physically record and see versus project a hypothesis, which may in the end be true. Believe me, I don't have any problem understanding it may be true. But until you take care of some basic needs here, and that's why we can call it disappointed, we can call it upset, but for something sitting there for a year and a quarter without it, clearly a biological entity of some form, whether modified or not, and to not have that positively identified, to me, is just, again, reprehensible.
Clifford has always spent a great deal of time making damn sure that what he presents is demonstrable, is visible, is not speculative, and that's crucial, and that's how we build science.
The next stage, Jeff, we're going to run short pretty soon. I'll try. Well,
we have about a minute to the break, and then we have 6 minutes more after the break.
Yeah. So here we go. At this point, we've got something that's starting to involve the entire human body, by the way. And I have other points to make about that someday, about the human body is not the end of the scope here, folks. You know, we're talking about the planet, and this whole thing has been about health. From day one, and it's not just the health of the human body that's at stake here that we're
ridiculous to think this is confined somehow to human mammalian issues.
We're talking about the welfare of this planet, and have been from day number one.
Right.
But there is this paper on here next called A Fourth Match, and this was rather an intriguing episode as well as a really open a door for something. But you had an individual that had extreme tooth pain, just extreme, incredible. And I can only say that this method did not come through rational means, let's say logical rational means. This is not a cure of any kind. It is not even a therapy for that matter. But it is a test. It is a physical test that involves the use of red wine, optionally with peroxide. It's also being learned that organic grape juice also appears to be effective.
Huh.
But by rinsing the mouth with red wine and or peroxide mix, and doing this several times for extended, several minutes in the gum, there's a rather fascinating discovery that took place. And that is that with the vast majority, and again, I try to be careful, Jeff, but the fact is 30 out of 30 people that have done this, every single one of them is positive so far.
Wow.
But there is a fibrous network that is being expelled from this wine and or optional peroxide sample that when you put it underneath the scope, is exactly the same form we're talking about. And this is where, I'm sorry, but nobody's off the hook right now. Every single individual that I have tested thus far or has reported to me is showing this fibrous network existing within the gum or mouth network.
All right, stand by right there, Clifford, and we'll be right back. Okay, and we're right back. It's Clifford Chronicom. If you go to rents.com, look on the left-hand side, look for my Morgellons section, look under Morgellons articles. Scroll down there, and you'll see Chronicom research on Morgellons, and we're talking about some articles that are on that data page, and certainly Clifford's website as well. They're all there. Okay, and on May the 8th, Clifford will be back, and we will spend two more hours on this. We have much to cover. We have about 6 minutes left, my friend, so go ahead.
That's great, Jeff. Thanks. I will hold off on this discussion of this dental test until we meet next time and go into more detail on it.
Can you do a minute on Rife here at some point?
Yeah, exactly. I think that would be helpful. And my interest is this. There are people, myself included, that may have an interest in frequency approaches towards a resolution of certain problems going on.
Yes.
And, I've done a great deal of work on the ELF side of things shows the continued ambient presence of apparent, by all means, artificial ELF propagation in the environment. It's just been done over and over and over for years. So we have an electromagnetic component to this that has been established in a very, very strong way. So it's quite reasonable to consider that at some point, electromagnetic methods may be used in some way to, let's say, interfere or cause disruption. Again, we had my caveat at the beginning, and we have it again. I'm not a doctor. I'm not advocating even any therapy. In fact, by the time we finish, I'd like to mention a pretty strong caveat. But nevertheless, the subject is one very worthy of investigation. And my position is, you know, for anybody taking on a frequency approach, this business of just trying something is ridiculous to me. You know, the idea that I'll just try a frequency and see if something happens.
It's totally asinine. It's offensive to so many different aspects of this problem. This potential, Clifford, is clearly one of the most promising of all, but it will require maybe years of diligent, backbreaking research by a true scientist or a
Absolutely.
Team of them.
Absolutely. Has to be done right. And, I'm just getting my feet wet in terms of finding out what's going on. But I have this position from the beginning that, you know, if we're going to get involved with this subject or anybody is, well, you know, we need a physical basis for what we're talking about.
Yeah,
we got to have a model of what it is we're even approaching the subject with. And I was curious whether or not anybody else was showing that same intent. Because as I find tables and such a frequency, they're saying, well, you know, these have been found to work. But there wasn't any rational
That's crap.
Basis.
And if anybody tells you, buy a Rife instrument and be cured of Morgellons, yeah, run, don't walk. This is crap.
Yeah,
there are no known frequencies to deal with this period, okay?
There was no basis given there. But I did a search, and I just wanted to sort of bring the attention of the audience to a certain patent that I found very interesting. And may have some significant connections as we go along.
Right.
And the title is, I'll give the specifics, and then I'll try to get through this quickly because I know we're running out of time.
3 minutes.
The title of the patent is called Methods for Determining Therapeutic Resonant Frequencies. To show you how current this is, this just was published in October of last year. And the patent number is 7280874, and it's by a lady named Charlene Boehm, B-O-E-H-M. And it's rather fascinating because her approach to this is really with the same intent that I have, and she's trying to establish a physical basis. And what she has chosen, what she believes is significant, and it is patented, which is quite interesting to me. It was accepted. But the DNA of the particular organism that you are dealing with is what she uses as a basis for determining a resonant frequency.
Uh-huh.
And the reason this is going to be important to me, we'll talk more about this next time also, but one of the reasons that I want to know what these things are, it's not okay with me to have these four forms and just be calling them oblate spherical structures. You know, I've made my best reference of chlamydia, like chlamydia pneumonia is a candidate to me. But you need to know what you're dealing with. And when you start considering this approach that's going on in this patent, you're dealing at the genetic level, the DNA. You need to know exactly what it is you're talking about before you even begin to consider any kind of frequency approach. And the caveat on this is you better start thinking about, if you're going to adopt this method, you better start thinking about the human being, because a human being has DNA too. And what are you going to do? If you don't know what you're dealing with, you're playing around with something that makes no sense. But if you do know and you do get these things identified and you do have a rational basis, then you have a sensible line of investigation to follow. And sorry for the little tirade there, but that's
very
what
well
I wanted
said.
To get to at the end.
The name of her paper, or her patent again, is?
It's called Methods for Determining Therapeutic Resonant Frequencies. And I've done some work on figuring it out. She gave an example, which is very helpful, and I've done some work that we'll talk about next time that raises some interesting
Sounds like a very bright and accomplished woman.
It's quite interesting, and you know, it's dependent upon having specific genetic information available to us, and it's why we need to know what these things are we're talking about.
And once we have a handle on that, we can begin legitimate, serious research.
Exactly, Jeff, and I thank you for making that point. It's exactly the case.
All right. Clifford, thank you for all you do and all you've done. Thanks for being here tonight. Anything you'd like to leave us with in the last minute, and we'll pick it up on May the 8th.
No, I think we'll continue. And next time we have a little ring to show that a person sent to me that's a little bit interesting, a little ring in the sky that we need to talk about.
A ring in the sky.
Yeah.
All right. One quick comment on chemtrails. There is no let-up. They are continually being reported around the country. Anything new in that environment?
Other than the reason that this whole discussion of Morgellons has evolved to the level it is, it appears as though there is a very direct connection between both issues, and that is the state of our general health and the state of this planet. And I will be giving a talk in California in May. People can look up on that if they're interested, too.
Very good. All right. Thank you, my friend. Great to talk with you. I look forward to May 8th.
Jeff, thanks for everything. I do, too.
Okay, take care.
Yeah, bye-bye now.
Clifford Carnicom. All right, that's our, I think, our 13th Morgellon special. We'll do our 14th with Clifford on the 8th. So again, if anyone comes up to you and tries to sell you a Rife instrument saying, hey, this will cure everything, tell them to get lost. Should you have a Rife instrument, in my opinion? Absolutely. I consider them to be life insurance. If the stuff hits the fan, you're going to want to have one in your toolkit. Now, there are many frequencies, of course, that are well-established or well-known, which are effective on a wide range of issues. Nothing works for everyone all the time, however. Keep that in mind, too. Okay, we're going to pause and be right back.